All right, today is April 30th, 2015. This is Carolina Hernandez. I'm with Jordan Gaines in College Library. And for quality purposes of this recording, Jordan, can I have you please spell out your last name for me?
G-A-I-N-E-S.
Okay, I'm going to actually turn it up a little. I think it'll use a little bit more volume. Okay, that should be better. All right, so let's start off with some background information. If you could tell me where you were born and a little bit about your childhood.
Okay. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, born and raised there, as was my mother and my father. My childhood, my mother, not remarried, but she married my stepfather when I was about three. And they had two more children, my little brothers. And my stepfather had two sons from previous relationships, so we were a family of seven. we're a big family. And they got divorced when I was maybe in the eighth grade, but I was essentially raised around that family, so I still talk to my stepdad. I still am pretty close with, like, his side of the family and things like that, but right now I just live with my mom and my two little brothers. My older brother, my stepdad's son, he still visits me all the time. Mm-hmm. He's, like, 4 years older than me. But, yeah, we're a very close family. I always lived in the same neighborhoods as my family. Most of the houses I've lived in are either, like, owned by my grandparents, right next door to my grandparents, or just, like, so I always lived in a neighborhood where I have, like, family. Right now I live in a duplex owned by, like, my great uncle and aunt, and they live downstairs from me, and then across the street is, like, some cousins, and then the house next door from my cousins is actually my mother's childhood house.
Wow.
So I guess I stay pretty close to family and, like, my roots and things like that. Yeah, and that's pretty much how it's always been.
Cool. Can you tell me a little bit about what school life was like? Elementary, middle school, high school, whatever was really most important to you.
Yeah. So for most of my life, I went to Catholic school. I went to St. Rose Urban Catholic Academy or Catholic Urban Academy from about first grade to sixth grade. And it was a Catholic school, and most of the staff was predominantly white, but the school itself was made up of predominantly Black and Latino students, and it was, like, in the middle of, like, a predominantly Black and Latino neighborhood. And that was, like, probably, like, the beginning of, like, my social skills, I guess, as a child. Like, I got some, like, my first best friends there, some of my first, like crushes and, you know, fights and all that stuff that, like, defines adolescence, I guess. And then I went to this charter school called the Young Leaders Academy, which is around the corner from where I live now. It's in the Northside YMCA, a private charter school. And that's probably where I got all my character building and all my networking. Most of the people that work there were heavy influences on my life, like second parents to me. Very important people who really influenced who I am. And my brothers also went there, so I didn't graduate from there, but they really cultivated me into the person I am today. But I went to private high school for, like, the first 2 years, and I went to public high school, and I did the same when eighth grade. I actually graduated from a public middle school. So I spent most of my schooling in private schools and in charter schools, but I have both my eighth grade diploma and my high school diploma from the public school system, which I think that gave me a really different experience when it comes to, like, how I view education and the value of education, because I got to be in very different types of systems between, like, public or private charter schools and urban Catholic schools versus suburban Catholic schools, which is where I went for high school, versus Milwaukee public schools. It's all very different, the way that education is regarded, the student demographic, obviously, but also just, like, the way people care. And so I think that's something that really drew me to, like, want to be an educator, which is no longer what I want to be, but it's what I wanted to be when I first came to college.
So with that goal in mind, did you pick UW-Madison specifically because of that, or was there something else that led you here?
So, no, not really. I did not have the best high school, like, experience. I hate high school, hated high school. I would never go back to high school. But part of the reason I came here, because I didn't have a good time in high school, and mostly because of the First Wave program. So the only thing I did have in high school that I felt like I did well at was poetry, was spoken word, was performing. I performed all over. I won a lot of things from performing, and like it made me feel good, which is also why I transferred high schools. I transferred to a arts high school because I wanted to cultivate something, because I just didn't feel like I was like doing well. I wasn't confident. I just was not the best of spirits when I was in high school. And because of that, I didn't believe in myself enough to really apply to a lot of places. And so I applied here because I knew I would get First Wave. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that, but I knew I would get First Wave. But I didn't think I would get into Madison. I thought it was too good of a school, and I didn't think that they would take me. So I also applied to Marquette and UWM. And I didn't get into Marquette, but I did get into Madison, or I did get into Marquette, or UWM, but I didn't get into Marquette, and I didn't think I was going to get into Madison because I didn't get into Marquette, which made me really sad, but I got into Madison. So I kind of just came here because it was like the best option out of the things that I thought I could attain. Looking back on it, I certainly could have applied to other places, but so when I got into it, I was actually extremely happy because it was like, it wasn't like my dream school, I want to say. I don't think I had a dream school. I don't think I dreamt about school, but it was definitely like my goal school kind of thing.
So you're a junior now, and you're majoring in English,
yes.
Correct? What led you down that path? You kind of spoke about poetry a little bit. Did that have something to do with it?
So, well, it was more so actually education. So I did not come here for the education program. If I was solely basing my decision on education, I probably would not be here, because the year that I applied, the secondary education program was moved to a graduate program. And so what I was originally told was to major in English, which was like what I would have majored in had I done the secondary ed program. And then I would apply to like a graduate program for education, and that would be like, I think it was like a year and a summer or something like that. So that was my original track, was to major in English and obtain an English undergraduate degree and then get a master's in education. But all of my high school teachers told me no, that that was not a good idea, just because I would have less experience than everyone else, but I would require more money because I had a higher degree. And so like as far as like being employable goes, I might not be desirable as a candidate to hire. But yeah, so, but I stuck with English because that's what I'm good at. It's always something I've been passionate about. I've always been a whiz kid when it came to English, as long as I can remember. I love reading and I love writing. So I stuck with that. I've tried to change my major a couple of times. I thought about elementary ed. I thought about comm arts. I recently thought about journalism, but I always end up sticking with English. I did add Afro-Am with the emphasis in Black Women's Studies to my, so I'm also majoring in that, but yeah, I kind of just stuck with English because it's kind of second nature to me, and it goes hand in hand with journalism.
So did that kind of, so you're working now on The Black Voice, you're bringing back this newspaper. Can you tell me a bit about that and kind of what inspired you to do that?
Yeah, so I work for the Office of African American Student Academic Services, and myself and my boss Carla Foster, we planned Black History Month. We've been doing it for the last 2 years. And so this year we did a theme of celebrating Black activism. And because of that, we really decided to like live in the archives and like look through the things that had happened on this campus as far as Black activism, Black presence goes. Because there was just a real lack of acknowledgement of the Black presence on campus, I think. And she's been here as long as I have. And so we both could agree on that. And so while we were working on that, I was also breaking the news to her that I might have to quit because I didn't get into the J school. And so I wanted to seek other options as far as working for newspapers or doing something that would like flex my journalism muscle, because I wanted to have some sort of experience on my resume for when I was applying to graduate journalism programs or if I chose to reapply to the journalism school. And that was not an option for her, for me to quit. And so she informed me that I should make this job what I needed to be. And so we did. And lo and behold, while we're in the archives, she found the Black Voice. And she's like, why don't we bring it back? And I'm like, okay. And since then, it's become my baby, my brainchild. And the inaugural edition was really just about letting people know what it was. It came out in a time that was like really intense with like communication and everyone trying to get their voices out, And I felt like I was in somewhat of a unique position because I work for the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement, but I'm also a student. And so I felt like I was kind of in the middle, but not in a kind of a frustrating way, but definitely in a more beneficial way. I thought I had some sort of advantage. And so I wanted to do something or use this as a tool to where I could take those student voices and kind of get them to administration, because I felt like I had a little bit more access, I guess, to administration because I worked in or at least in that division. But moving forward, I'm definitely rethinking how I want to do it. And it's still very much so under construction. Right now, I'm in the process of working with the faculty in the journalism school with it. And so that's probably why it's been on hiatus, I guess, kind of. But yeah, I'm really just trying to make it sustainable, but effective, because I want it to be a couple of things at once. I want it to be a safe space for Black students, because I think that although there are safe spaces for students of color on this campus, they're confined to physical spaces, I guess. Mm-hmm. And once you leave those physical spaces to go to, like, I don't know, class, which is what you do when you go to school, you don't have those anymore. You don't have that safety and that security. And that's unfortunate, because we have to spend most of our lives as students in student or studious or academic spaces, but those usually aren't safe spaces, and those are usually the hardest spaces to make safe. So I want that to be kind of a convenient or a easily accessible safe space. And I guess right now I'm really trying to determine who my audience is, because I want it to be kind of a for us, by us, to us kind of thing. But at the same time, I don't want it to be censored. I want the messages and the concerns and the sentiments of the student body to be very clearly understood and heard by administration and by our non-Black or non-people of color peers. But at the same time, I don't want that, like, knowing that it'll get into the hands of an administrator or get into the hands of students who aren't Black or aren't of color. I don't want that to then hinder the message or what people choose to say. Yeah. So I guess that's that balance that I'm trying to find right now with that. Honestly, I'm sure that the student voices will speak for themselves, which they did in the first issue. And I think it might be different because I am a student. And so I do have my own opinions. And so I also try to determine how much of my opinion I want to put in it, which is sometimes very difficult because it's like, I'm a student, I want to get my voice in it. But it's like, at the same time, I want to take a step back, because naturally as a writer and as a journalist, like, and also I talk to people and I realize that there are situations or like hardships on campus that I'm just not familiar with because of maybe an aspect of my identity. Like, obviously the things that Black students go through are different from the things that the Latino Chicano students go to or the Native students go through, or, you know, and so when engaging with those students, I also have to check my privileges and oppressions, kind of thing, when talking to those students, because they're just different. They're things that I don't know. And so I have to check my assumptions also when trying to get those stories, I guess.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit more about the structure then of the paper/website?
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the, you know,
mm-hmm. columns. So the first issue was a paper. It was a hard copy. We printed about 100 to 150 copies. I still carry some around every day. And so the front page artwork was an artwork by a graduate student named Althea Miller, a wondrous woman. And she did a painting was called Still Black at WIS.edu. And it was about almost feeling like she was, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she gave us like a little description. But how I interpreted it is about like almost feeling like being here was an attempt to whitewash her kind of thing, but her Blackness and therefore her identity and therefore herself prevailed despite that. And so that was the front cover. And then I used a quote from the first issue of the first volume of The Black Voice, explaining what it was intended to do by the original students who put it together, which was really crazy to like read and retype. I don't know. I had like a moment with that, because it was like very like, I felt really in tune with, you know, in that moment. And so that's, I put that message, I reiterated that message in the paper. And then I have a portion that's called Black is the New Black. And so that's an artistic portion. So we had some poems. I had poems by First Wave students, Sean, Avery, Medlin, and Hewa. And then I also had some artwork by a faculty member, Jerry Jordan. And he's had his artwork featured a couple of places around campus in Madison. And then the bulk of it was an article that I did. And so it was released in February. So the article was really coming off of the December die-in and the protests and the overall grand scheme of the Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matter movement. But more than that, I really wanted, what I saw was students had made this demonstration on campus in December. And we were in college and we were doing the die-in and we were marching up Park Street and things like that. But university response was, it was either look at our badgers kind of thing, like look at our students standing up for Ferguson or standing up for New York and things like that. So it was an accountability for like our actions. It was kind of almost like this is a badger spirit kind of thing to take credit for the actions of the students without acknowledging that the students were actually, it was a solidarity with Ferguson and with New York and with all of these other places, but it was also a stand of, we're not going to take what's happening here to us on this campus. Not even all the way touching on what's happening to people of color in the city of Madison. We're talking about this campus, which a lot of those things go hand in hand. But like, and so that was problematic for a lot of students was, yeah, you all are not recognizing that this environment is problematic. And I didn't interview Rainn Wilson, who's the Associate Artistic Director for First Wave. I interviewed her for a different magazine that I do some freelance writing for, Umoja magazine. And she said this very, very intriguing thing. And she said, when a Black boy gets shot by a police officer, we can all sit and mourn and be in a state of agony and say that is a violent act. And what she said, what I want to see with the work that people do in Madison is I want them to see that having 75% of Black children living in Madison below the poverty line is a violent act. Having Black students come to this university and be marginalized and tokenized, that is a violent act. And so there are violent acts happening right here. But instead of acknowledging those and fixing those, this more so of a, we're all going to sit back here and look at what's happening over there and say, oh, that's so sad, and then feel good in our pseudo-liberalism because of it. And so that was something I wanted to acknowledge. I wanted to make it very clear with the first article, which was titled Lift Every Voice, that the students were not happy with the way that the university was trying to, a lot of ways, pacify our concerns or pass off our actions as some sort of badger pride, when this, for a lot of us, been the exact opposite of badger behavior, and it's why we don't consider ourselves badgers in a lot of ways. Or a lot of students who were saying that the first time they ever really felt like a badger was when they were laying on the floor in college library doing a die-in. And it's because it was the first type of solidarity or oneness they had with like a community here at Madison. It is the first time they didn't have to confine that solidarity or that oneness to those safe spaces that I was thinking about, that I was talking about. So that was the purpose of that article. And students said some really intriguing things. And it wasn't just all the way like a, we hate Madison, let's all attack the university. I mean, and the questions I asked, I really sat down, and I only asked 5 questions, but I really made sure that I carefully worded them, because I asked questions that call students to not only reflect about the university, because we have countless conversations about how the university is not the best environment for us, but to reflect on ourselves, to reflect on the way in which we move forward, the actions that we take and things like that. And so the students were very vocal and I appreciated it. And I got students, I had freshmen, sophomore, juniors. I don't think I got any 4th years, but I did get 5th years. And I also got faculty and staff. And I also got graduate students. So I wanted a wide array of representation. But yeah, that was the bulk of it, was that article. and just really about like Black students and their voices and the fact that they are here and they aren't happy being here or they aren't satisfied.
Changing the subject a little bit, you've mentioned First Wave a few times. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about your involvement with that group?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm a First Wave scholar, member of the sixth cohort of First Wave. And First Wave is a hip-hop and urban arts learning community. And what it does is it provides a tuition-free scholarship for 4-year, fifth if you need it, for you to come to this university. It's a fairly diverse program, I guess, compared, I could be wrong, I don't know numbers exactly, I guess I'm just going off what I see, but in comparison to, like, the other programs that bring in, like, students of color, like, i.e. Posse and People, First Wave probably brings in students from, like, the most array of places. Like, Posse does, like, focus cities, but I think we only have, like, 5 Posses here, maybe, so that's 5 cities, mm-hmm. and First Wave, we have been pulling people from literally everywhere, Hawaii, Philly, New York, L.A., the Bay Area, Florida, Louisiana. Like,
oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, well, First Wavers are literally from all over. We have someone from Rhode Island. Like, we have First Wavers from every crevice of the country you can think of. And it's only a matter of time before we get them from out of the country as well. If we already haven't, I could be wrong. But yeah, so it stands on 3 pillars: arts, academia, and activism. And so it's pretty much this group of students who have these talents rooted in what a lot of mainstream people would not consider conventional art, because a lot of it is hip-hop art. I mean, we do have some instrumentalists and things like that, but a lot of the artists are spoken word artists or rappers or graffiti artists or breakdancers or, you know, things like that. Things that you wouldn't think you would be able to get a college scholarship for. And so it's not uncommon to find a First Waver who might say, like, I would maybe be in college if there wasn't a such thing as First Wave. Mm-hmm. Or I wouldn't have thought about coming to college if there wasn't a such space as First Wave in a university like this. And so that's pretty much what it does. It cultivates us. It provides lots of opportunities for you to strengthen your art. It links you up with amazing faculty and staff. Like I said, our artistic director is Rain Wilson, or our associate artistic director is Wayne Wilson. Our other associate artistic director is Chris Walker, and he's been with us since the beginning. The program came about, I don't want to misquote this, I feel like 2007. We're on our 8th cohort now, so I don't know if you just count back from 2015 to, from eight. But yeah, so we're on our 8th cohort now, so it's a pretty young program, but it's made major strides, and it's been really influential, and it's really gotten its name out there, and the connections it has with, like, the greater hip-hop community. And we work pretty close with a lot of faculty and staff, like I said. Yeah, it's a pretty cool program.
Yeah, sounds like it. Have you been involved in any other sort of extracurricular activities or other groups tied to academics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's see, where do I begin? Well, my freshman year, I joined the Zeta Xi chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, which is, it's a lot of things, I don't even know where to begin, but it's one of the 9 predominantly Black fraternities and sororities, historically Black fraternities and sororities. It's been around for over 100 years, but we came to this campus in 1969, and our focus since inception has always been public service, social justice, and activism, things like that. And like I said, it is a predominantly Black sorority, but we do have members of an array of racial identities. But yeah, so that's what I do, and I don't know, like, how familiar you are with, like, Black sororities or whatever, but you kind of, yeah, but yeah, well, a major difference between, like, Black sororities and, I guess, like, mainstream sororities or, like, white sororities is you're in them forever. You're in them for your life, and so it's, like, a major thing to join one. It's not something to be taken lightly at all, because the idea is that you kind of commit yourself to that sorority and to the mission of that sorority and to the service of that sorority, until your last days. So I've been in that since my freshman year. I was grateful enough to be initiated, in spring of 2013, and I've held several roles in that organization. I've been the treasurer, and I was the program and planning co-chair, and I'm going to be the program and planning co-chair again. And then besides that, I also was on the e-board for the Wisconsin Black Student Union. I also was a member of the African Student Association like my freshman year. And then other than that, what I really do with Carla, like working with the Office of African American Student Academic Services, for the most part, my position is the Student Leadership Outreach Assistant. So my whole job is to really just stay reaching out to other students. And like mainly I do that through like organizations and like keeping in touch with like student of color organizations, primarily like Black student of color or Black organizations or ones that target like Black students or African students, which there aren't like that many. And so just keeping up and up with those students and what they're doing and what their organizations are doing nationally and locally. So I've kind of had my hand in a little bit of everything on campus and just like staying up on what's happening. Yeah, that's mostly what I do. The bulk of what I do is between those through organizations. And, oh, well, through the office, through Carla's office, we also have, like, a planning committee for Black History Month. So we gather students in, like, September who might be interested in those students. They meet and we plan for whatever programming or events or initiatives we're going to have going on in February. And as the office assistant, I'm always the chair of that committee. But yeah.
It's definitely a lot.
Yeah.
Well, you've talked a little bit about being involved in activism and social justice, mm-hmm. both through the Black Voice, but also through your sorority. Do you want to talk a little bit more about how you've been involved, especially in recent months, with how the movement's really been strengthening here in mm-hmm. Madison? You know, any events you've attended or just the extent of your involvement in that?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm more of a, I feel like I'm a kind of get in where you fit in kind of a person.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a couple of things. Our office has had events that have been in response to a lot of things. In September, we had what I thought was a very successful event, and it was called Black Lives Matter. And it was, I guess, I don't know, I feel like it wasn't as popular of a saying then, or maybe it was and just hadn't like popularized itself here. Because I remember like that wasn't the initial name of the event, and someone suggested it, and we're like, oh, that's really catchy. But like now it's like so obvious, like duh. But yeah, so we called it like a Black Lives Matter forum. And that event I thought was really successful, and that was September, I believe. And so it was not far off from the murder of Michael Brown. We hadn't gotten to the non-indictment yet, but it was like so when the murder itself was still fresh. And so what we did is because we realized like with media and things like that, it's very hard to know what happened or what's going on. So it was my job to sit and like look through all of these different media outlets. And this is where I really appreciate social media because you get a lot of firsthand accounts of what's happening with like as far as like live tweeting and even better videos. And I just kind of sifted through all of that to put together a rough timeline of events so that students can kind of know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And also because people say things like attention wanes, and once stuff isn't like in your face through social media, you kind of like forget about it. And so there were times where I feel like students were popping in and out, and especially with school happening or school starting, people were just like losing their ability, I guess, to keep up. So whatever the case, we provided this timeline to kind of let students know what happened. And I believe I did the timeline from him being murdered up until his funeral. And then after that, we had So IJET, that's what it was. IJET, which is a part of the Multicultural Student Center, they did the presentation or like an activity on just effective student organizing and effective student responding when things like this happen on campus, or, you know, like the effectiveness of like, are you really going to be effective if you just like picked up and drove to Ferguson right now, you know, kind of thing, and kind of help students like sort out the next step through like that, like you emotionally respond to something like that, but then it's almost frustrating because you don't know what you can do, what you should do. It's like, can you really go to Ferguson? you're in school, you know, or, you know, or are you, is that a sacrifice you want to make because you do believe that you can be of that much use? So just kind of helping students sort through that. And we also have United Council come, and that was a very colorful presentation from them about like what it means when you say Black Lives Matter and things like that. And the event was, it took place in the Multicultural Student Center Lounge. We had about over 100 attendees, which I was not expecting. I remember I was so nervous because I thought it was going to be my usual peers that I see at all the events like that. But there were like grad students and there's like faculty and staff. And I'm like, what if I say something wrong? Like, these people might be way more up on what's happening. And I was like, so I was really nervous, I remember. But yeah, I mean, there was, our dean of students was there. There was some people from UHS there, but it wasn't even kind of like none of those people I just named were there in a sort of like a, they were there to offer like their services per like their job description, but most of them were white, and so they were also there to just listen and learn, which was very crucial because, you know, I mean, watching students' reactions and being informed of how students felt, heavily informed, I feel like, what they're supposed to be doing here, because there are students here who just happen to be Black. So, you know, you can't really offer counseling services and help with the mental state of someone if you don't fully understand their experience or why they might be feeling the way they do. So that was, I thought, a pretty great event. And there was a lot of questions posed. It was a very raw space, despite there being like a lot of a mixture of people in that space. It was a very raw and open space. And so that was one of the events we did through the office, which I thought was really good, and I enjoyed it. At the end of that, we also had Michael Johnson, who's like the president of the Boys and Girls Club. He had been to Ferguson, so he spoke on his experience and what he saw out there and what he could bring back or any gems he could bring back to us about what was happening and like next steps. And we did a couple of events like that. I did an event with the MSC, which was similar. it was very different. The event with the MSC, essentially I showed up. What happened was I showed up and maybe like 30 minutes, an hour before the event started, and they were all meeting in like the director of the MSC's office, like Carla and all these other people and a couple of students, and they had me come in with them, and they're like, okay, here's what's happening with this event. We are going to break everyone off into groups based essentially on their racial identity, and you will be facilitating the Black group. And I was like, okay. So that's essentially what happened there. I believe white students went one place. It was like, I believe it was broken almost into, it wasn't worded like Black students, white students, non-Black people of color, but it was implied, I guess. I can't remember the exact wording. So yeah, essentially I ended up with the facilitating the group of students that were Black. It was more so like how you feel about your interactions with like police and police brutality. So if you feel like you are more, you know, plagued by police brutality or whatever like that, or if like the things in the media that have been happening lately regarding police brutality, you feel like heavily reflect you kind of thing, either physically or, you know, emotionally, then go into one group, and that's how it was. And so naturally with like language like that, it sifted out into like Black students being in one group, non-Black people of color being in another group, and white students being in another group. And so that was a pretty interesting event. It had its pros and cons, I think, because a lot of Black students naturally talk to each other. And so I wish there would have been more time for the groups to kind of bring back to the other groups, because I think it's not the issue of the access we have with one another. But it was an opportunity to create a safe space, and really like, and maybe talk to people in our community who we maybe didn't have access to before for whatever reason. So events like that is usually what happens. As far as like, and so I'm usually delegated, like as you see, from like a more of a programmatic or administrative standpoint, I guess, with like the MSC or like Carla's office, and just like, hey, can you step in and do this, or can you be this voice or what have you, which I don't mind. I try to translate a lot of that into my student organizational work. I incorporate some sort of social justice something into almost every event that I've ever planned for my sorority since I've been the program planning chair, because I think it's important. I've seen the same things with like BSU. As far as like other student organizational work with like CEES, are you familiar with CEES?
Is that
it's Deshaun. Yeah, it's Deshaun's group. SECE. I don't want to mess up what it stands for. It used to be called About Race at UW, but yeah, and I don't want to mess up the acronym. But yeah, SECE.
I think it's Students for Education and Climate Equality.
That sounds about right. Yeah. Yes. So as far as like that goes, I kind of pop in and out. Just always, I talk to Deshaun and things like that. Just always letting them know that I'm available for resources. But I think one of the most like insightful things I guess I heard is when I was interviewing Deshaun, and also when I was interviewing Janetta, they both said the same thing. For the Black voice, they both really reiterated how important it is and how crucial it is for people to be able to accurately identify their place and like the grand scheme of things as far as like the work they can do in the movement. Mm-hmm. And I know it for some people, it's like, it's so much to do. I can't do everything, so I'm not going to do anything. And it kind of melt down.
Yeah.
And for other, which I've been there. And for others, it's like, I'm going to do everything and then nothing gets done. I have not been there, but, and so like, that like really resonated with me when they said that. And so from that moment, I really dedicated myself to figuring out where it is that I can fit and where it is I can best serve without exhausting myself or without shortchanging myself or the entire organization or like the work that's being done, because I'm dropping the ball and therefore, you know, I'm like stopping the flow of things. I would never want to do that. And so that's been what I've really been committed to, is recognizing what it is that I'm good at. And doing that, because I think for a minute I beat myself up, like, I should be doing more stuff on the ground, I should be helping people organize stuff, and I should be doing this, or I should go to every march they have in Madison and Milwaukee, but it's like, then I probably won't graduate if I did that. and it's okay to say, it's okay to say that, you know, and it's okay to want to graduate from the school that you been at for the last 3 years. And so I think that that's really important. So I think that's something I'm really working on, and just like radical self-care and things like that. Telling myself no is probably the most radical act of self-love I can do.
I feel like I've heard very stories from people in terms of what kind of the extent of, like, you know, either discrimination they've experienced or witnessed. What has been your experience here in Madison, but also just on campus with that kind of problem?
Mm-hmm. So thankfully I've never experienced any physically violent act towards me. I've experienced very few like verbal or emotional assaults or things like that. For me, I think what I experience most is just like really heavy microaggressions, and I experience most of them in the classroom. I kind of just tune out when I'm like walking around campus, or I'm always like with my group. So like, if something has happened towards me, I probably would not even have picked it up because I'm so in my zone. But definitely in the classroom, it's really frustrating. And I talked about this at a student panel I sat on for a like forum or what have you that the MSC had like last month. And Carla did a presentation, and I sat on the panel for that. But, like, a lot of the classroom microaggressions that happen, they're really small. I mean, it's simple things like staring, or just kind of looking like, you know, do you go here? Or anytime anything having to do with race or Blackness is mentioned in class, everyone looks at you. And not even to be like, not even looking at you to be like, can we get your opinion? Which does happen, and that's also frustrating. But, like, looking at you to, like, I guess make sure you're okay. I remember I was sitting in my J202 discussion like last semester, and we're talking about freedom of speech, and somebody said something along the lines, and it wasn't outlandish or offensive, but it was just talking about the differences in like abuse of freedom of speech, and they were saying like technically the KKK had freedom of speech or whatever like that, and everyone in the class looks at me. And they're all like, oh, he's so disgusting. Can you believe he just said the KKK? And they're kind of like all like trying to like look at me and like be in solidarity with me. Like, oh, I know he didn't. I'm just like, that's true. They did have freedom of speech. Like, and it's like to the point where it's like you have to almost be like a stone statue and watch how you like facially react to things. Right. Because it's like with something like that, I know immediately that people look at me. So I immediately am like, okay, watch how your face reacts. Because they're going to be looking for your face to react a certain way or make a certain twitch or something like that. And it's just like those types of things are really frustrating, because it's just like that sort of like behavior and how much more you have to be on your P's and Q's. Honestly, I've liberated myself from a lot of things that I know a lot of students or that I experienced like my freshman year with like, don't do certain things, don't talk a certain way, don't be a certain way, like, I don't care about those things anymore, because, I'm making my own space here, and I will not go crazy for the sake of someone else's comfort, but, yes, it's little things like that, and just, like, watching the way you react, or, like, when things come up in class, and I don't feel bad, but sometimes I'm exhausted, but, like, if we're discussing something in class, and it's just, you can tell that it's really being spoken from like a viewpoint of like the white normative gaze kind of thing. So you have people, I mean, it can be something as simple as sitting in a general women's studies class and everyone is talking about like, I mean, I don't even know, like we're in general women's studies class and someone's talking about like women's expectations, you know, and this just happened like maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, and someone's talking about the expectations of women and someone's like, yeah, women are expected to be skinny. It's like, oh, not necessarily am I, like, you know, and so it's like even things like that, and so it's not always even like, and in that instance it wasn't like an annoying thing or just it, but it's like, okay, do I raise my hand and kind of like, you know, or do I just nod as if some of these things that are being related are my experience, and there's been things that have been like much more extreme than that, but just like everything is kind of spoken from a viewpoint of implied whiteness for the most part, no matter what subject you're in. And I used to take a lot of Afro-M classes at once, and at first I loved it, and then, like, half of the semester, I was relieved to, like, go to my journalism class or, like, my general women's studies class. I'm like, I can't talk about race anymore. I need to, like, come up for air. But it was inevitable. I mean, you can't talk about advertisement and media without talking about race or, you know, those sorts of things. You can't talk about girlhood sexuality and development without acknowledging that that's different for women based on like their race. So being in a position where it's like, do I shortchange myself by not forcing people to acknowledge that that's a different experience so that I can better learn, or do I say something so that my experience is included in the class because that's affecting how I learn, because while everyone else is getting the opportunity to learn a lesson that's created to be tangible or relatable to their experience, it's not to mine. And so I always have to make that choice, and just be like more active and avid in, I guess, my learning, which can be very unfortunate. And I know it doesn't sound like that harsh, but it can be very exhausting. And then also just being put in a lot of the positions that I'm put in with like speaking, like, Because I do a lot of like speaking for like stuff for like the MSC or for Carla's office, that usually draws not just like other students. When I do stuff for student organizations, the audience is usually other students of color, you know, who know me, and that's a much more comfortable environment as opposed to all these other people, because they kind of look at you as like some sort of resource, and that's exhausting. And just little things like that have been like the most frustrating to deal with.
Yeah, I've definitely heard a lot of people mentioned microaggressions as being like the worst. Well, I guess looking forward then, what would you hope to see improved overall, in either a concrete or abstract way, on campus? What do you hope is the outcome of all of the activism that's kind of going on right now?
I think a major thing is university-wide acknowledgement. I think what happens is you know, the dean of students or some administrator will show their face at an event, say, look, I care. Look, this is a priority to us. Or, they'll make a comment or they'll make a tweet. But what's not happening is when the same person enters spaces that are occupied by the majority of students on this campus, meaning more predominantly white students, those same sentiments are not taken into those spaces. And so it's like they come into our spaces or they come into student of color spaces trying to give off this air of this is a priority and this is something we care about, but it's not prioritized in other spaces. And so, and therefore it's almost, in a lot of ways, ineffective because it's almost just like you're pacifying.
Sorry about that little interruption. If you want to continue.
But yeah, I think as long as it's not like a, it really doesn't seem like it is, as long as it's not a faculty concern, then the classroom, the microaggressions in the classroom, by some of which are from faculty, can definitely continue. And I think that it will take the faculty to like push administration, to like push students kind of thing, because I do think this is a very faculty driven university. And I also had people say that when I interviewed them for the newspaper. And so those are things that I think that definitely can change, but just definitely taking, not just like, okay, I'm an administrator and I'm going to walk into a space occupied mostly by students of color. Let me put on my, like, I care about students of color hat. Oh, okay, now I'm leaving this space. Now I'm going to put on my, like, everyday white person hat. Because, I mean, that's perpetuating the divisions, right. You know, for me. That's how I view it. And so it's not really caring, honestly.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of the questions I had prepared for you. I don't know if there's anything else, though, that you would like to add that we didn't touch upon or that anything you want to just elaborate?
Not really. I guess if I had to say anything else, and this is something I touched on in the newspaper that I'm fairly passionate about, it's probably my views on diversity and multiculturalism on this campus, which I guess goes in hand with the question you just asked. I definitely think that the idea of like we love diversity or we support diversity or we encourage diversity, it's not enough. Because first of all, the definition of diversity, it's thrown around so much that students don't even know what it means anymore. And I'm not diverse. I'm Black. That's, you know, that is my identity. And there might be students who identify as diverse, but that diversity, you know, that's not an identity. And things like that, or like this whole push that's happening where it's like multiculturalism, I feel like is another way to just kind of like placate the anger or like emotions of like the students of color here, because it's like it really homogenizes us and all of our needs and things like that, to the point where not only are you saying we have one sweeping problem, but you think that you can fix it in one sweeping solution. And you think, and then that also makes students think that they are more culturally competent with one sweeping step. I took my ethnic studies course and now I know, kind of thing. And so it's just not, it's not realistic. It's not realistic at all. It really does just smash us all together. And that frustrates us even more. Personally, I would like to see us get our Black Culture Center back, which is something that we had in the 70s. I think that we need these university-inspired safe spaces, not ones that we create ourselves, because it's exhausting. Students of color, they fund their own events, they fund their own organizations out of their own pockets. I've seen students spend like $500 on things for their student organizations or event, a single event for their student organization, and not in a free one, because simply because you want to create a continual, stable space for students of color. And there's no reason why you should have to do that. Like, there's no reason why those spaces aren't university supported and university funded. And so, like, things like that is just very frustrating. And then when you ask for things like that, you get, like, you know, and I love the MSC, but, you know, you get the Multicultural Student Center, you know, and that's fine, but I think that students need something for them. Or even, you know, or and not to mention when you're a student who has various other aspects of your identity, you know, don't be a student of color who's also, you know, LGBT or a woman or, you know, or might have some sort of or might be handicapable or, you know, differently able or anything like that, because then, you know, like, and this is not to, I've seen that the Meg Berner Center or the LGBT Center or the Campus Women's Center can be very supportive spaces, but, you know, it's, then you have to try to find, you can't just go to those spaces because all of those spaces have, like, you know, that sort of, like, white normative ideology and some more than others. But, you know, you have to then break through that to kind of find your space. So you're constantly finding space. And then you're constantly having to choose the aspect of your identity because diversity is not just race, you know. Right. Diversity is a myriad of things, and we talk about it like it's just race. And so not only do we homogenize everyone's racial identity, but we completely just glance over everything else, like your gender or your sexuality or, you know what I'm saying, your ability or anything like that. And so, I think we have a lot of work to do as a university. And I know it feels like maybe we put a lot of pressure on this university, but I mean, isn't this supposed to be like a research one institute? I think we're more than capable of, you know, pioneering some of these initiatives. But yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining me and for being very candid. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and turn the recorder off now.